This is tape two of the George Jackson interview. When the last tape ended, we were talking about your trip to Marquette with a group from Pakistan.
Yes. And, there was a plumbing problem, and Dr. Hamid Khan, who was leader of that group, had gone with me up to the room, and there was a sink torn halfway out of the wall, and a very frustrated Pakistani trainee, you could say, who said, "I knew there was water in there somewhere, but I didn't know how to get it out." And later at one point, Glenn Taggart was very good, because I did go to Nigeria. I should go back to that story and tell you more about it, but I'll interrupt it for a moment. When I was really working on the Nigeria program mainly, but doing other things for international studies, Glenn Taggart wanted me to see other projects. He was that kind of a leader. He thought this guy should know more than just what he's doing in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. We went to visit several projects, including the one at Comilla. And there I was following Dr. Hamid, who I'd met earlier, to see some of the work. And my vision now is just, we're walking along the bund of a rice paddy. The rice paddy is about 2 feet deep, full of water and rice plants. The bund is about 1 foot over that, about a foot or a foot and a half wide, mm-hmm. and relatively dry. And you're walking along it in single file, of course, because you fall in the water, maybe even then. And he's going first, and I'm trying to keep up with him. I can hardly do it, running on this thing. And all the while, he's lecturing. And we went to several meetings of farmers, and he organized some very dramatic, important approaches to involvement of local people in their own, quote, community development, which people like us have been teaching for years. And he was way ahead of us. I mean, we all agree, first you got to listen to them and learn what their world is like, and then you do other things. But the reason I got into the Pakistan story at all was that one of the things that, a picture that was in the administration building, and maybe in the dean's office now, shows that one of these big rice paddies and a whole single-file line of tractors was driving them. Well, you know, the Americans thought tractors was the way to farm. In fact, as a kid, as I mentioned, I thought that too. And so we did one of the obvious things. We sent tractors to Bangladesh. Because that was a problem. I don't know how big this room is, but farmers' fields were not much bigger than this. I mean, if it was in terms of feet, maybe 20 by 20, that'd be pretty big. Some would be twice that size, but not too many. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't turn a tractor around on that. So they had to reorganize the social structure and get people to cooperate. And also one family, because of inheritance, would own several plots like that in different locations. They had to do a lot of social organization to get them to have 10 of them in a row that they could argue to get a tractor on to make it go the length and come back. We had to train tractor drivers. We had to train tractor maintenance people. They set up a tractor maintenance shop at Camino, all kinds of things like that. And I visited there several times over the years. It wasn't too long before they all sat in that beautiful row, resting. Because in Bangladesh, they had a shortage of land and a surplus of people and a shortage of money. Mm-hmm. Now, in the United States, when it was growing, we had a surplus of land. All our history, even till about then, we had a surplus of land, a shortage of labor, and plenty of money. It was coming in Europe as much as you could borrow. So it was just the reverse thing. If you have a surplus of land and a shortage of labor, you need agricultural mechanization. If you have a surplus of labor and a shortage of land, the last thing you want is to mechanize. The real goal, as I learned later in India at their research station, instead of having a hoe with a blade about 10 inches wide or 8 inches wide to hoe in the garden, you need a hoe with a blade 2 inches wide. Because that way you can grow another row of the thing next to it, or you can plant seeds in one row and then wait 2 weeks and plant in the next row, and wait 2 weeks and plant in the next row, and by the time the first ones are getting big, little ones are started, and then you harvest one and do it over again. Mm-hmm. You want to intensively produce as much food as you can from a small piece of land. Yeah, and good agricultural engineering research would be making smaller and smaller blades on the hoe. But we had bought tractors, and I just offer you that as an example that we were naive and arrogant. Well-meaning, well-educated college professors went to places all over the world to try to really help them. And some of them were colossal failures, some of them were tragic failures, and some of them we gradually learned how to do it. And another thing, I'll give you one more example of that, because I think it characterizes what the well-meaning Americans in point four tried to do for the first 20 years or so. We sent a home economist from here, And she went to Okinawa to our project there at the University of Ryukyu's, and she was going to teach women about food and nutrition. So she got the 4-H bulletin, and one of the first ones you start with is how to bake a biscuit. Because 20 years before her time, every farm home had a wood stove, and the oven was always hot, so you had a hot oven. They all had cattle, so milk was easily available, and everybody had wheat. And they had shortening from lard or whatever else. So you had the ingredients already on the farm, you didn't even have to turn on the stove, and you could bake biscuits. So we taught level measurement and things like that to girls in 4-H by making biscuits. So this well-meaning, honest young woman, not all that young, went to Okinawa, and she organizes groups, and she wants to teach them how to make biscuits. Well, they don't have ovens. Not to worry, we just had a war. We had all these 5-gallon gas cans. You could make two, one on top of the other, use the bottom for the fire and the top for the oven. And, you know, with a little bit of work and some help from others, you could make ovens. And you could get fuel. Wood, it was scarce, and people cooked on it. Usually 3 stones in an open fire, that's what they cooked on. But this would be more efficient. And then they didn't have the fat that goes in it, or the lard, so she was able to get from the U.S. military, so they have big cans of Crisco or Spry. Wheat they could bring in sacks, so you brought your own artificial things. And they had dry milk they could make powder out of. There was a dairy. There were dairy cattle on those islands before, but not lots of them. I mean, it was a home dairy at best if you had one, and goats are much better than cows because they don't eat as much and they still produce milk. So she went through a year of work, really, getting all the things together so that she could teach them how to make biscuits. Now, none of them cooked in a stove. And I'm just saying, in reflection, you see, I don't know whether she ever got it or not. Probably not. She rests easier in her grave if she doesn't ever think about it. But that was a waste of everybody's time and money. Now, it wasn't that she was trying to do the wrong thing. It's very much like the tractors, you know. But these are two examples of what was typical of what the U.S. did in terms of organization, structure, governance, and the technology of agriculture and home science or whatever. And we were very slowly learning. And I said, Michigan State taught me a lot because President Hanna said, what about going to Nigeria? And I don't think I said, why should I go there? But I said, well, let me think about that. He said, okay, why? You and Nancy, he even knew our wives' names in those days. He said, you and Nancy, think about it. And I went home, and to be honest with you, we got out an atlas. We had one. We looked at Africa. Now, where's Nigeria was our first question. Now, here I had a PhD by then from an American university in Austin. We put our fingers on Ethiopia, and we couldn't find it all the way down the East Coast. We went around South Africa. We went all the way up the West, and sure enough, there was Nigeria. We found it. I'm just telling you that, and whoever's hearing the tape, that was our level of college professors' knowledge of the world. Mm-hmm. Now, this was late in 1959. Into 1960, because it was in 1960 that the Nigerians became independent of England, and I think on October 1st of 1960 was Independence Day. We already had a small team there, and but they had trouble. Dr. Ezekwe's great idea was to just scrape the land in this valley, which he controlled, and build buildings on it. He'd seen some pictures here and there. He didn't have a campus plan, although President Hanna was a great campus planner and had lots of campus plans to show him in the expansion of this campus to the south, which he'd been working on for years and years. And Ezekwe had a sort of slight idea about that, but he wanted to build buildings, and he knew that he's got to get it built quickly and get it started, otherwise the political pressure there will destroy it. For one thing, there was already a university college in special relationship with the University of London, which the British had started in many different colonies, and one was at Ibadan in Nigeria. In fact, one thing that drove him to Michigan State, him now I'm talking about Ezekwe, was that he went to this college at Ibadan, which had started giving degrees, and he noticed all of their exams were made in England. Well, the British didn't want their colonials to be second-class people, so they should pass the same exam. Some of our thinking about exams is similar today, here. Well, he went to the greenhouse because they want to show him this beautiful greenhouse. And inside are all the plants of England. You know, they could grow the nice bushes and flowering plants and so forth that we have here, which are grown in England. And he looked out the window. There's a banana tree. There's a coconut tree. He said, do you teach about those? He said, no, because, you see, we get the Cambridge exam, and it comes with the questions, and they're all about And we have the lab manual that they work with, and we need to plant some of them in formaldehyde bottles of England so they can learn about those to pass that exam. And Ezekiel said, is that going to help Nigeria move into the 20th century? And he thought not. He came here and he talked to people who were not very enthusiastic about that. In fact, he went to Palmolive Peat Building in New York City, which has a big sign on it. And you know, their main export crop was palm oil. And the palm oil was coming here and other places, and they make it into soap and products like that and sell it. He went to, I don't know how he got the appointment, but he went to see, he's going alone for all these things, not as part of, he was then Governor General of the Eastern Region of Nigeria. He went to see the executives of that place. He said, we'd like you to give us a big grant to start a university with, because we need one of our own that will teach people how to live in this country and apply science to all the needs of our country and bring the country into the 20th century, because we're not now. And they wouldn't listen to him. So he went back to Nigeria, and since he was Governor General there, they passed a law in that region, which was the main palm oil producing region, and they put a tax on palm oil. So every gallon of palm oil that was shipped out of Port Harcourt or any other port there, a certain amount of money had to go to the government to the fund for the university. So that when he, Ezekiel, talked to John Hannah and said, I'd like you to come and see my country and see the possibility of university, he already had the money. He had enough for to operate, to build the buildings and start operating the university for the first 5 years already in the bank. And President Hannah went with him and he looked it over, he came back here and he started telling all of us about this great opportunity. And you know how he drove on this dirt road all the way from the last little airport in Enugu all the way up to Nsukka, and here was this village which had only mud huts with thatched roofs, but here was this land and a university could be built here, and he was excited about it. And I hadn't paid much attention to that at all, but anyway, back to the story. He said, take a few days, and my wife and I thought it over. And you know, it had implications for both of us and the work we're doing, and all they were asking me is to become the coordinator of it, and to spend time here and there, to go back and forth, to straighten it out, to recruit staff for the project from our staff and build it up, because our contract called for an ever-increasing staff, to maintain contract relationships with the U.S. aid agency. It had changed its name at that moment, more or less, and to also go there and recruit Nigerians, turn out to find Nigerians all over the world who had college degrees or who were college students, and convince them to come back there and be teachers. We had an office in the University of Nigeria, now had a little office in London with one old British colonial officer there who was supposed to help recruit people who were in England from Nigeria. And I remember President Hannah taking my elbow as we walked down the stairs from his place saying, you know, our relationship with the British is not too good in higher education. In Nigeria, they think high quality higher education is all done in England. Anything coming from the United States is third rate at best. And he said, if it comes from a land grant place, it's probably fourth rate. Now, your job is to build a good relationship in London with those people so they will see the need for what Ezekiel is asking. And Ezekiel said, I want a university who will not be a copy of your land grant schools and not be a copy of the British university. It will be uniquely Nigerian to fit the needs and the interests of the people of Nigeria and help them apply knowledge to their problems and solve them, etc. And he gave me this little try. He said, now it's not going to be easy. I'd never been to London. I'd been to Guam by then, to Honolulu, and Palau and Kwajalein, but not to Europe. Mm-hmm. And but he said, you know, the key thing you have to do is build a good relationship with them and get them to support you. I said, yes, sir, or something like that. You know, I didn't know what I was talking about. And again, I started travel. I still had this Institute of Extension Personal Development. I had students who weren't through yet, but they convinced me that we need to get a new person to take over that. And I should fly to London, meet people from the University of London, fly to Lagos, Nigeria, the capital, meet people there in government and in our U.S. aid agency, and then go to Nsukka and meet that staff and figure out what needs to be done next, and then come back and tell us and we'll help you. And it was, you know, a very important part of my education. I mean, I was forced to learn about British higher education. I think I have great respect for it. And now, but to get into it in some depth, they had a committee called in the University of London called the 24 Colleges Overseas in Special Relation, because they had colleges overseas. They had started in Singapore and in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia and several other places besides Nigeria, and that one in Ghana too, I think. And they were university professors in their system trying to really replicate their system in these other places. And anyway, I went there and learned a lot. I went to Lagos and met those people, flew in a DC-3. I thought they were great. I used to fly them long back. Mm-hmm. And to Enugu, and then our MSU group had bought a few little Fiat vehicles which were available, and so we drove a little Fiat bouncing over that road, which was then paved in the middle. They were paved for 9 feet wide, the rest was, and there were already lorries, motor trucks running back and forth, and they always stayed right in the middle. So if you're going the other way, you either get off or get hit. And the beautiful signs on them all saying, like, no condition is permanent, or one, God's case, no appeal. So he's coming down the road straight at you, his side. You get off the road in a hurry. Anyway, I drove up to that campus. I met our people, and I learned a lot. And yes, and I could tell you details of that first trip.
How
and
did
second
you?
And third. Well,
when did you first meet Dr. Azakiri?
It was later than that. Mm. By then, he had become president, and he had moved his office to Lagos. He came out for some occasions. He had a little home, a sort of his country home, that had been his before the university came, on the edge of the campus. And I met him there. When you say first, I'm not sure what the first was. Mm-hmm. Because then over the years, he was the chancellor of the university, which is sort of a figurehead, and the vice chancellor was one of our team members. And that wasn't working out very well at all. And we had like six people there trying to survive, and one of them was the administrative guy. I'm glad they had sent us to bring an administrative guy, but of course he didn't know how to do administration in that place. So we had like four families, maybe one bachelor and three families, and our guy who was supposed to be in charge of it all. And they wanted little things like toilet paper. Well, you could buy them in Enugu, that's 40 miles away. And you had to get some quantity and you had to transport it over there. And, they wanted coffee and creamer and a dozen other things like that. And they didn't know what they were going to need, but they needed everything. They needed to find servants and hire them, because you could hire a cook and he could find food and cook it for you and know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And it'd be nice if he also spoke English language. And so that gentleman had a tough time trying to manage the thing. USAID sent an auditor out at one time, and our friend got so angry at him, he picked up a chair like this, and he was about to hit him over the head, but the other guy could run faster than he did, and he chased him across the campus. Things were not going well with him, and we had a thing called a transit house. That was one house set aside for short-term people to come and go. A very important thing, not my idea, but... And when I got to the transit house, there was a British professor who had also been sent down, and he was staying at the transit house, and the two of us were taking our meals together. That was a good part of my education, too. In the middle of one meal, our administrative officer came in. He was just furious. He grabbed a dish or a glass of water from the table and threw it on the floor and smashed it. And he said, "I've had it. I'm not going to stay here any longer." And he was really at the end of his rope. And I talked to some others, made one trip back to Lagos to see the U.S. government people and the U.S. psychiatrist, because they had one there that connected with the embassy. And they had a long talk, the two of them, and then, wow, this gentleman was still, I'm not giving you his name because I don't think that's appropriate. Mm-hmm. But, and you can find it in the records anyway. Mm-hmm. Psychiatrist came out and said, "I can understand all he's saying. The same thing happens to me here. You try to get something done and nobody will help you. And you do and all the frustrations he's having, I'm having trying to run my practice. But my suggestion for him is that you get him home as soon as you can." And of course he didn't want to go and that's another story. But we gave him some special vacation leave in Europe, where he also had interests and whatnot, and brought him back to this campus, and he survived. And then we started a program of recruiting personnel for that university, which after a year or two got to be a resident staff of MSU faculty of about 30 individuals, mostly families. We were building houses, and of course, one of my campus responsibilities was housing assignment, both for the Nigerians and for our people and for anybody else who came, and things of that sort. Anyway, I came back here through London to talk with them, and my main job was recruiting the rest of the staff. And so, in summary, I was responsible for recruiting about 15 families each year to go out for a two-year assignment at this place called Nsukka. And then 15 the next year, and then we had 30 there. At the end of 2 years, the first 15 went back, and we rotated that for 7 years. And
Is from 1960 to 1967?
To 1967,
okay.
And there were short-term people also, among our deans and things like that. They couldn't think they could spare themselves for that long, but they would go. We did have trouble getting a vice chancellor there. We have to get a Nigerian person to be the top administrative officer and run the place. But our recruiting was difficult, and we found somebody who was Eni Njoku. He was good, had a good experience. He was involved in other things at Abaddon and elsewhere, and he could come, but it was going to be about a year, more or less. And so Nnamdi Azikiwe called on the phone one day and said he wanted to have Woody Varner to come out and be his vice chancellor. Of course, by then Woody had set up with the Oakland campus. I said, he's a man who knows. And we used to have breakfast meetings. President Hanna was very good on breakfast meetings. He liked to have them at 7 o'clock in the morning. And we had the Kellogg Center then, and we had several over this topic, and at one we arranged it so that we have Ezekwe on the line from Lagos, and President Hanna in the room, and Woody Varner, and Glenn Taggart, and myself. And what he wanted Varner to do, you know, just didn't fit that he could be spared by MSU. He was just getting Oakland started, and he was, I don't remember what they called him there, maybe a chancellor or something like that too. And there were all kind of political things with, before that, as vice president for off-campus affairs, Dr. Varner had been our main go-between with the legislature, especially in the name change. He really, I mean, President Hanna gave the overall leadership and the great ideas, but Woody did the day-to-day political thing to convince the legislature to make that change, because the U of M people were not at all in favor of that. In that telephone discussion, it was agreed that maybe Glenn Taggart could go. Now, Glenn was our Dean of International Studies and Programs. He had met several times, and this was still a maybe thing. But the result was that, yes, Glenn took his youngest daughter and his wife, Phyllis, and they went there for a year, more or less, and he was the vice chancellor. And I was back and forth many times in that period. And I guess when I did that job for 7 years. Yeah. And for the first five, I was going back and forth regularly. My routine, not by planning, but just came out about 6 weeks here on the campus doing recruiting and other such things. 1 week in London, making peace and negotiating. 6 weeks in Nigeria, discovering the problems and working out what happened there. 1 week in London, 6 weeks in East Lansing, 1 week in London, 6 weeks in Nigeria, and I did that for the rest of the 5 years. And
at that time your family was here?
My family was here. My wife went with me once. In fact, she did her master's thesis there because she was working with Lee Pelucci on family decision making. We said, gee, polygamous families are different than these monogamous families. Mm-hmm. And she went there and studied the polygamous families and did her thesis on that. And one summer, My wife wasn't going to put up with having our son, who was maybe 12 or something like that, in the house, because she already had a baby daughter and an older daughter, and so he went with me for a while. That summer, I was the acting vice chancellor, and I guess it was before Glenn got out there or something. And so again, we were there for maybe longer, maybe 8 weeks that time. And another contribution to my education. Not only in trying to do that job, we had in the project, by that time, worked out a partnership with NUFIC, the Netherlands University's Foundation for International Cooperation. And so we had some Dutch faculty that they recruited, and we helped recruit those too. And with the 30, we had them in all different academic fields. And there are reports of this for anybody's interest. Maybe I've said more enough about the
hiring
program.
You're the first one that I've talked with about the record. So
for me personally, it was a great learning experience. Uh-huh. And the kind of stories I was talking to you earlier about people in Okinawa or in Bangladesh, we did some of the same dumb things there. Mm-hmm. An excellent agronomist who had worked for Michigan State in two other countries, in Colombia and one other, and been very successful, went out there in our College of Agriculture and cleared a place on a hillside and planted corn in rows, like you do here. Mm-hmm. And the first 2 or 3 weeks, they were nice and green, and it was beautiful, and he was very happy about that. About the third or fourth week, it turned sort of purple, and by the fifth week, you couldn't even find it. Now, as a rural sociologist, I've from the beginning been going out visiting rural villages there, and my wife did her studies in rural villages. The agriculture of that area is what they call a three-level agriculture. You have vegetables and small plants, even corn, growing on the ground. Then in the middle you have bananas and palm, oil palm, coconut palm, things like that. And at the higher level there are big trees with leaves. And you not only have the shade, but it's intensive agriculture. They grew it in intensive farming. They would grow yams. And also, socially, yams are a man's crop. The man grows the yams, has a yam barn where he puts them in something like a tobacco barn here where the air can blow through and preserve them for the rest of the year. And men in the village compete with each other who can grow the most yams, the biggest yam, and all that kind of stuff. And then the women are allowed to plant between the yams their spices and vegetables and other kind of things. And there's a family garden, and they might have two or three of those places on the land that they worked. Well, our kind of agriculture didn't fit that at all. We're into rows. In fact, agronomists to this day, most of the world, they say you should plant in rows. And later on, we had the same experience in Nepal. We're working again, starting a College of Agriculture. And all the agronomists want, and the books all say plant in rows. Well, mostly the planting is done by women throughout South Asia. And they're standing in mud up to their ankles or their knees, depending on how the thing is there, going backwards. They got a sack on their back with a handful of rice plants to transplant. And they stick them in one at a time. And they make a sort of U-shaped thing, because if you start on your left and work to your right, that's what comes out. Then you take a half a step backwards and you make another one. Mm-hmm. So the rice fields, if you look at them, are a bunch of these U-shaped little things. And they work. And the people doing the work can do that. And then, in the typical thing, if you say what works in Michigan should work anywhere. And here, if you plant anything, you plant it in rows, because number one, we got a tractor. Before that, we had a horse pulling a plow. Well, if you're doing it yourself by hand, then we've had agronomists give all kind of reasons why technically they'll grow better in rows, which I think is a lot of baloney. And these are some of my best friends I'm talking about, because we have worked together and struggled through these things. But mm-hmm. And again, now you've got another example. I didn't plan the same sort of phenomenon. We didn't know the questions, much less the answers. And a lot of things about education were similar, but we had the fundamentals. And that I can thank President Hannigan. He kept reminding us, you see, that this school of agriculture started because farmers in the state of Michigan wanted a school that would help them prepare their sons and daughters to work on the farm and in the shops, which we call mechanic arts then, and apply science to that so they could do it better. And book learning was all right, but we didn't want too much of that. And it was a battle on that course at MS. MAC when it first started. We had a very academic curriculum, but the rule was every student had to work on the farm. And they, out, right out your window is where their farm was, and it was wet land, and they had to work in it and work in the mud. And it was a good thing for them, and that, in several other countries, I have utilized that principle, and usually the local, if someone is on the college faculty as a teacher in horticulture, for example, he wants to read from a book. Now I'm going to skip from the Nigeria project to others, because if we're going to get anywhere in this, I have worked on a lot of projects. I was there for 7 years, learned an awful lot, came back here, and then we had a lot of cleanup to do. The evacuation is another whole series of stories, because when that part of Nigeria seceded and became Biafra, and the Nigerians didn't like that. We tried to convince the U.S. government and the British government to support this Biafra. All they wanted, because like in so many other places, you know, the control was in Lagos for Nigeria, and that's where the money was, and they wanted to extract as much as they could from their provinces like the Eastern region, but not build the roads and schools and health posts and things like that. And it, they would all be built in their own place. So they decided independence would be a good thing. Yes, all of us were sort of against it because, you know, this is going to be a big mess. We tried to convince some other governments to support the Biafran government, as it was called, and they refused. So it was the Biafrans alone. They had some connections in Portugal and Lisbon and some other places, but not any support officially. But people were sending, they declared independence. The U.S. government decided